loss of this facility is very unfortunate, but it does speak to the times in which we live.
Nikiski loses its gas-to-liquid plant. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 2nd of September. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the race to restore power and phone lines in Eagle.
We have people on the ground working with a contractor also to supplement our local workforce to get that work done as fast as possible.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
NSTAR Natural Gas is working on plans to import liquefied natural gas to fill Anchorage's anticipated fuel needs as fuel supplies in Cook Inlet become scarce. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Cook Inlet natural gas is getting harder and more expensive to find, causing concerns that an unusually cold winter or an equipment failure could lead to service disruptions to its users. That's a threat South Central utilities and governments are taking seriously. Presenting short and long-term plans to avoid shortages in the Cook Inlet areas it services, NSTAR's manager of gas supply, Mark Slaughter, told the House Energy Committee that contracts are in place to carry the municipality through the next 2 years. That's barring any unexpected weather event or equipment malfunction. And he says the company is negotiating with Cook Inlet suppliers and building storage facilities that will provide sufficient gas for South Central's needs through 2012. Responding to questions from Fairbanks Republican Jay Ramris, Slaughter gave NSTAR's longer-range plans.
At what quarter, in which year, will you begin working on the contingency plan for the importation of foreign LNG into Alaska?
We're working on that currently because it's going to take a significant amount of time to negotiate that, to come up to speed on that, to educate the state, to educate the RCA, to educate the entire community as to what that involves.
Slaughter said the outside sources it's looking at are in Canada, Russia, Australia, and Indonesia. He told the panel that his company's also looking at a mix of other options, such as new contracts, curtailing delivery to some of its commercial customers, and encouraging conservation by residential customers. Slaughter said that with easy-to-find, less expensive gas in short supply, he doesn't see many options, such as new in-state exploration in Nenana or Gubik near the Brooks Range. And opportunities to link Alaska to national supplies are now off the table. He told Ramirez the company's still following the Parnell administration's work on developing a North Slope supply, but has backed off from its previous role in that project.
Quite frankly, I don't care where the gas comes from. I just want to make sure I have it contracted for, and that producer is going to produce the gas when I need it.
Madam Chair?
Representative Ramirez?
Quite frankly, I do care where the gas comes from. I have 100,000 people I and some of my colleagues represent and that we all represent as members of the state of Alaska. And so it's a big darn deal to me.
Ramirez said the lack of natural gas is hurting the interior's economy. It's put Fairbanks under environmental limitations. The city's lost its principal natural gas contract and just recently lost an electrical utility supplying 17% of its needs. The idea of importing gas is totally unacceptable to supporters of an all-Alaska natural gas pipeline. They point out that voters in 2012 approved an in-state gas line from the North Slope to Valdez. There, it would be available for use within Alaska or converted to LNG for export. Former Governor Wally Hickel led that issue.
If our gas, if we bring it to Valdez, we can ship it to the world. We ship it to Hawaii. We ship it to Japan. We ship it to Korea. We ship it to the world market. It is criminal. I mean, to bring it in from Australia or someplace.
He heatedly blames North Slope leaseholders for not making gas available years ago and state officials for not standing up to them. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
BP's gas-to-liquid facility in Nikiski is set to close by the end of the year. The company opened the plant 7 years ago to test production of liquid fuels using natural gas, KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
Gas-to-liquid production uses a catalytic chemical reaction to convert natural gas to other forms of hydrocarbon. The method was first used in Germany over 70 years ago. Many changes in technique have occurred over that time. BP spokesman Steve Reinhardt says the process itself involves gas put into a reformer and heated, which creates a synthetic gas called syngas.
Carbon monoxide and hydrogen, essentially. And this intermediate product is then further converted through this catalyst process into synthetic crude oil, a clean diesel and jet fuel primarily, also some naphtha components.
Reinhardt says work done in a lab needed some real-world testing to further research. When the Nikiski plant opened in 2002, the company announced they anticipated it to run for about 5 years. Reinhardt says BP saw additional opportunities once the plant was up and running, which kept it open another 2 years. Despite the end result being a clean fuel, the amount of energy required to do GTL can be cost prohibitive and doesn't produce a true low-carbon output fuel. Research at the Nikiski plant involved exploring efficiency. What's different about the BP facility is that the reformer is much smaller than other similar equipment.
It is a compact unit, and that's a proprietary BP technology and one of the things that we were testing here.
Reinhardt says the Nikiski location was chosen because of the workforce available, the natural gas available, and a market for the small amount of product produced during the testing.
This plant took about 3 million cubic feet a day of natural gas and converted that to about 300 barrels a day of essentially diesel and jet fuel.
Reinhardt says that the tests show they're able to make the process reliable, operable, and commercially available on a large scale. He says they also made other discoveries, but their proprietary nature keeps more specific details unavailable. Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Dave Carey spoke to the Borough Assembly about the closure on Tuesday and says he was concerned about the jobs.
It is wonderful that these individuals will be offered jobs somewhere else, but it is very unfortunate that we lose the quality of life and their expertise and knowledge and the community spirit they have. So the loss of this facility is very unfortunate, but it does speak to the times in which we live.
25 people are working at the plant, 15 are BP employees. Reinhardt says they could be moved to BP jobs on Alaska's North Slope where their expertise is needed. The remaining employees are contracted for a variety of services. Reinhardt says while their service is valued, the project is coming to an end. After the facility closes, he says there will be months of work to safely clean and then clear out equipment. Other companies like Shell have used a similar process to produce low-sulfur diesel fuel and wax in Malaysia. The United States Navy has experimented with a related process that creates jet fuel out of seawater. That's a complicated procedure still being researched. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
The state and federal government will help fund power and phone service repairs in flood-ravaged Eagle. State Division of Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zydek says parties have come together to help the utility Alaska Power and Telephone foot the bill.
The State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management worked with FEMA and the power utility and the community to really develop a way that we could fund the electrical upgrades.
Zydek says under the arrangement, APNT will be responsible for $367,000, with the state and federal governments picking up the remaining $1.7 million in repairs to Eagle Area transmission infrastructure. Zydek says the assistance dollars will be funneled through local government because APNT, a private company, is not eligible for direct disaster assistance. He says leaving the entire cost up to the power company would have resulted in excessive local rate increases.
To accomplish the project, they would have really put electrical power out of reach as far as rates go to the people in Eagle.
Much work has already been done this summer to repair and replace power and phone infrastructure in Eagle. Lines have been rerouted to the higher ground between the city and the new Native Village. Alaska Power and Telephone President Bob Grimm says next step is to extend them out to individual building sites at a subdivision being developed in the village.
This area is a greenfield development where the village has been relocated. One of the problems is that a lot of the home sites really haven't been cleared yet. so that, you know, there needs to be some civil work done that wouldn't be our responsibility as far as getting the new locations ready to accept power and telecommunication services.
The line will serve at least 13 new homes as well as a health clinic. Grimm says a minimum of 50 new power poles have to go up, and the company has beefed up its workforce to get the job done.
We have people on the ground working with a contractor also to supplement our local workforce to get that work done as fast as possible.
He says they need to complete the project before the community's only road transportation link, the Taylor Highway, closes for the winter in October. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage School District reaches out to Yupik families.
I kind of bridged the gap between the Yupik customs and the Anchorage school system.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Thread helps families make good choices about early care and education for their children. Formerly known as Child Care Connection, Thread connects families throughout Alaska with quality child care, family child care programs, licensed centers, preschool or Head Start programs at no cost. Thread offers parenting workshops, resources, and help with parenting issues. Find out more online at threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread, connecting early care and education to Alaska.
Atonga's National Forest official has rejected appeals seeking to reduce the size of a controversial Prince of Wales Island timber sale. The agency says stopping the sale could kill much of what's left of the region's wood products industry. Environmental groups say their proposed changes would have provided wood and protected wildlife habitat. The conflict could end up in court. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
Tonga Supervisor Forrest Cole says he's ready to move forward with the logjam timber sale. It's slated to provide about 73 million board feet of lumber from an area southwest of Kaufman Cove. Cole rejected a joint appeal from the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, Audubon Alaska, and the Alaska Wilderness League. The groups proposed what's called a conservation alternative. Cole says it would cut the timber sale about in half.
Short term, it didn't make sense to me. Long term, it didn't make sense to me.
He says the alternative would not allow an economically viable sale, and that would mean no one would bid on it.
The logjam timber sale is predominantly conventional logging, which is cheaper than helicopter. And if we'd taken a conservation alternative, it would have made it predominantly helicopter. Had we done that, I don't think we would have had a full supply of volume that was suggested that we would have to make available, because a portion of it, if not all of it, potentially would have been deficit.
SEAC Conservation Director Buck Lindekugel says the alternative would have provided a solid, though smaller, supply for area mills. And he says helicopter logging is not really that much more expensive.
Given the landscape and given the problems that roads pose to wildlife, fragmenting the habitat and the like, it was important for us to come up with a way that provided economical volume without the exorbitant cost. And when you compare building road costs and helicopter yarding costs, it's closer than it appears first glance.
The logjam sale is slated for an area near Sweetwater Lake on the north-central part of the island between Thorne Bay and Kaufman Cove. Sections were logged about 20 years ago, and some roads are already in place. Lindekugel says the area remains a bridge connecting wildlife habitat on either side.
Prince of Wales Island has been heavily targeted, not only on national forest lands under the 50-year contract, but on private lands. And, you know, that legacy of industrial-scale clear-cutting, you know, leaves fewer options today in the 21st century.
The Forest Service says logjam is the Tongass's largest sale ready to be put out to bid. Alaska Forest Association Executive Director Owen Graham says it could keep Klawock's Viking Lumber operating.
They had been unable to harvest enough this year to get them through the winter, where logjam has quite a bit of low-elevation timber, and if we get any kind of an open winter at all, they'll be able to keep operations going by hauling off that timber sale this winter.
Viking is Southeast Alaska's largest operating mill, but Cole says the logjam sale affects the future of more than one company. That's because there are no large sales pending that could take its place.
And I think we've been very clear with everybody that if logjam fails, so does the industry, and the potential for transitioning from old growth to young growth pretty much evaporates.
Cole's decision is not the final word. It needs to be reviewed by regional forester Denny Bashore, who will act by September 24th. If it's upheld, the sale could be challenged in court. Linda Kugel says SEAC still wants to talk. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Next month, Anchorage's American Legion Post 1 will celebrate its 90th anniversary. As KSKA's Len Anderson discovered, the post's long history has created some fascinating memorabilia, some of which the group is sharing with the public via an exhibit at the Lusac Library.
The first indication of Post 1's exhibit is a small, glass-topped case. It sits at the entrance of the third-floor hall that runs alongside the Ann Stevens Reading Room, and leads to the Alaskana collection. Post historian Scott Harden points to some of the 24 or so items in the case. They act as teasers to the full exhibit.
This is history of the Ladies Auxiliary Poppy Drive and the membership cards for different members down through the years. The earliest one is Robert Romick from 1919, and you got Robert Reeves from 1930.
A prominent surgeon, Romig's name appears in Anchorage as a drive, a hill, and an Anchorage middle school. Reeve is honored with a city boulevard and remembered as the founder of Reeve Aleutian Airways. Even this diminutive introduction to the full exhibit, arrayed along the Galleria's long glass case, establishes a key element of Jack Henry Legion Post 1. Its story and that of Anchorage's are intimately intertwined.
The history of what Post 1 did during the earthquake is just incredible.
Jim Grant is post commander. He joined Harden in showing off some of the exhibit's high points, including the portion depicting the post's response to the Good Friday earthquake of March 27, 1964.
They supplemented the Red Cross and the other organizations in town that were responsible for civil defense and things like that. He was one on forward. It was around the clock. There was actually two children born in the post during that period of time, over a four-day period. There was nurses on duties, doctors on duties, 24 hours a day.
We have the pictures of two little girls that were born at the post.
What's compelling about the earthquake portion of the exhibit is that the focus is on people rather than damaged buildings and ripped streets. There's a photo of the long line waiting outside the post to be fed. Other pictures show people sitting with stunned expression as they try to appraise their situations, or simply understand the incomprehensible. The post's full name is American Legion Jack Henry Post Number 1. Historian Harden explains.
Jack Henry was the first man from Anchorage to be killed in the First World War. He was a signal corpsman, and he was delivering messages and was shot by a sniper.
Harden says after World War I ended in 1918, and based on a bond born from military service, some returning Anchorage vets began socializing together.
They got word that American Legion was forming in France in August of 1919, and they gathered and voted to go ahead and form with the American Legion, and they applied for charter on the 16th of September 1919 and were chartered 19 September 1919. We were in a race with Ketchikan, and the mail goes to Ketchikan before it comes to Anchorage.
As he gazes at the Lusac Library exhibit, Post Commander Grant says he regards it as honoring the past, but perhaps also a first step toward a new future.
What the American Legion stands for has not been pushed enough in the past 25 years. You know, we kind of got away from the tradition of it. And I'd like to get out and talk about this more. And bring the respect back that the American Legion deserves.
Some of that deserved respect will take place at the 90th anniversary celebration, Saturday, September 19th, at the Jack Henry Post on Fireweed Lane. The exhibit remains at its Galleria location on the third floor of Lusac Library through September 30th. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Picture this. Rose Rule, a petite woman wearing bright blue earrings and a colorful smock, is getting ready to go to meet one of her school families. It's the second week of school, and she's looking ahead to a productive season. Many of the Yupik families she works with are new to Anchorage, as was Rose's own family years ago when they moved to the city from a lower Yukon village.
My parents are William and Marie Tyson, and my husband is Mark Rule. My title in the Anchorage School District is Yupik Language and Cultural Liaison.
Photos of her siblings and family members cover the wall in her pleasant South Anchorage home. There's plenty of Alaska Native craft items decorating the house, too. Reminders of St. Mary's, where she spent her earliest years.
You know, I always went everywhere with my mom and dad, and they would just do these cultural presentations. And then, you know, I just went on into it even after my dad was gone. And so I was in and out of the school district for a long time, and I just really kind of fit for the position.
These days, Rose works with the Anchorage School District as a bridge between Yupik-speaking families and the sometimes bewildering array of programs offered by the district.
So whatever programs and activities are going on in the building, I let the parents know about it.
Her job is centered at North Star Elementary School in Midtown. She's got a cozy office there, although she does not work directly with school children. Instead, she reaches their parents through home visits and monthly workshops to inform them about supplemental educational services.
Which is basically free tutoring to families in all Title I schools.
North Star is a Title I school, one with a high percentage of students from economically disadvantaged families. Its designation is part of No Child Left Behind, and similar programs exist for Hmong, Spanish, and Samoan-speaking families. It's Rose's job to reach out to parents who are new to town and may be uncertain about what the schools provide or, due to language difficulties, unable to ask for help for their child.
I make a home visit once a month, and if the family needs me more than that, I make a home visit more often. The parent often will let me know what's going on, you know, at home, and then they can tell me, I don't want you to share that information with the staff. I just wanted to let you know. Or you can just tell the teacher, but I don't want anybody else to know about it. We're pretty confidential.
She calls herself a communicator, bringing basic information to families new to the school district. She prompts them to get the children to bed on time or make sure the children eat breakfast, if not at home, at the school. And it works both ways.
I kind of bridge the gap between the Yupik customs and the Anchorage school system.
More often than not, she finds herself explaining Yupik culture to Anchorage teachers.
Say the child is having a first dance and they have to leave town, and the teacher's concerned for many absences. So I need to explain to the teacher about the first dance, which is a really important part of the child's life. The parent prepares for a year, making their garments, and then they gather items for gifts to the people who've joined in on the celebration. So finally the big day comes and the child stands before, they should stand on a sealed skin rug, but they stand before the guests and their family passes out gifts to the community, to the people who are there.
Although Rose's efforts are focused on families with children at North Star, once she makes the connection, any other child in that family enrolled in any school can benefit from her knowledge of school programs. She says the monthly workshops are the best place for Yupik parents to get all the information they need.
The parents will have a really good sense of community. When they get together once a month and meet each other and work together and they talk about this and they can say, well, I didn't know that, and I'm really happy to meet you, and we can get, you know, we can work towards this goal together. That would be a really good sense of community for the Yupik. That would be really something.
This fall marks the start of her third year as a cultural liaison, and Rose's goal is to boost the number of Yupik families in the program. She says she's got room for 20 families and has about half that number now.
Talking to the parents and telling them about these things, just general stuff, Yupik to Yupik, hopefully it's going to make a difference.
Rose Rule, who heads the Yupik Language Cultural Program at North Star Elementary School in Anchorage. The Bering Strait School District last night dedicated its brand new $36 million school for Savunga. KNOM's Paul Korshin was there.
Young and old alike painted the gleaming new gymnasium with smiles as drum and dance groups from both St. Lawrence Island and Chukotka seasoned the floor of the new Hogarth Kingikuk School. Tuesday's dedication culminated years of BSSD efforts to design, fund, and build a replacement for Savunga's worn-down and weary predecessor. Terry Heyer of Anchorage-based ECI Heyer Architects said his firm strove to be attentive to those who matter most.
I'm just reminded of about 3-4 years ago and my first visit to Savunga, and I had the opportunity to meet many of you people and the opportunity to listen. And that was very important, I think. We listen to your needs and your wants. We listen to the district. And hopefully what we're in now represents what you were telling us those many years ago.
The steel frame building features sloping metallic outer walls in earth and sea tones, with energy-efficient fixtures and 21st century technology on the inside. The ceremony's guest performers included Erotigatuk from New Chaplino and Utasikun of Anadir, whose women wore long suede frocks beaded and trimmed with fur and caribou skin boots. BSSD board member Albert Washington of St. Michael exhorted the community to make its new school vibrant.
Our teaching staff within the school district to fill those teaching slots are second to none. But remember, as I said earlier, parents, they need our help. They need our continued help. That way, our children can succeed through our motivation, our encouragement.
At last, the moment came for the formal dedication by Board Chairman Weaver Ivanoff of Unocleet, as Savunga Mayor Jane Kava cut the husky blue and gold ribbons.
In honor of the elders and everyone in Savunga, the Hogarth Kingia School, from Savunga.
Dancing continued late into the evening as Yupiks from both sides of Beringia shook the rafters of Savunga's architectural and educational gem.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Kenai, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Paul Korshin in Savunga. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.